News Extra, December 2021. Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 1st of January 2022. Although this is officially our programme for December 21, by the time you listen to it, it'll be the first one of 2022. And, as you must know by now, my name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. And I've also taken a few stories from last week's edition, the less Christmassy ones. We'll also have a selection of really good national radio programmes coming up in the next week, which will be read by John. And then we'll have a selection of audio-described TV programmes for this coming week. And as usual, this is by courtesy of the Otley and District Talking newspaper. Following that, we have an article from the BBC website about the birthplace of Her Majesty the Queen, which will be read by me. And then we'll have a repeat of episode 5 of the 10 Today exercise programme, which you first heard 2 weeks ago. And finally, we have this week's birthdays and events this week in the past. The music in this programme is called Words and is by Gothby. So, now the news, and our readers today are Gabby, Marion, Wendy and Terry.
Hello, my name is Gabby and this first item is entitled Alban Arena Closure, What Happens Now to Venue? What next for the beleaguered Alban Arena? The devastating blow of this year's pantomime cancellation will have further repercussions in the coming months, with no positive end in sight. After 18 months of show cancellations and postponements in the wake of the pandemic, there was a palpable sense of optimism surrounding the return of the annual Christmas panto, Evolution Productions' Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But just days into its run, and following a 5-star review from this paper, the doors shut on the arena in response to a potential asbestos-related issue. It was hoped the panto would return after December 22nd, following further tests, but then came the news nobody wanted to hear. A spokesperson for St Albans District Council, SADC, revealed significant works are needed to the affected area, which is in a hard-to-get-at spot. We do not know exactly when the Alban Arena will reopen, but it could be some weeks, and pantomime performances will not resume. Contractors One Life, who run the theatre on the council's behalf, are now contacting all pantomime ticket holders to explain that future performances have had to be cancelled. It is not yet known whether the following shows, scheduled for January, will take place as planned. January the 9th, Hello Again Neil Diamond. January 13th, The Dream Boys. January 20th, The Music of Prince. January 22nd, Motown, How Sweet It Is. January 25th, Jimmy Carr, Terribly Funny. January 27th, Think Floyd. And January 28th, 29th, Omid Jalili, The Good Times Tour. SADC says there is no perceived public health risk from the asbestos, which is commonly found in buildings of its age, and SADC is working with RSK Asbestos, UKAS accredited asbestos consultancy, and Asbestos Essentials, HSE licensed asbestos removal contractor, to tackle the problem. The spokesperson added, The council is working with our contractor on a programme of works. This will allow us to understand the duration of any works and the probable costs involved. The focus of the works we are doing is to the stage area, where there is asbestos insulation that has been disturbed. The location of the affected asbestos means a scaffold is required, and we will need to encapsulate the area with air handling and specialist equipment. The removal and decontamination is notifiable to the Health and Safety Executive, HSE, which requires that we wait 14 days from when they're notified before the work can start. This requires detailed plans, risk assessments, and method statements to be produced and submitted to the HSE. These are being prepared. But David Koloshi, who set up the Save the Alban Arena Facebook group in response to council plans to demolish the venue and replace it with a new theatre, has condemned SADC for the way it has handled the issue. The actions that we have seen in recent weeks by our council, which is supposed to democratically serve our community, are despicable. As a direct result of the pandemic, theatres up and down the country have had to close their doors. Many have not reopened. In brighter times, we look to the Alban Arena to provide a rich entertainment centre, highly valued by local people and more widely in the local district. Yet despite almost 2 years of lockdowns and other restrictions, the council decide that now is the time to close the Alban Arena, albeit on a temporary basis. By closing the arena a week before Christmas, SADC is depriving the theatre of generating income, the cast and production team of earning a living, but worse, curtailing Christmas fun for the many families and groups who have looked forward to the pantomime to give some Christmas magic on the children who have faced lockdown, remote schooling and isolation from their peers, at a time when social interaction is fundamental to their development. The council closed the theatre while they decide the best course of action on dealing with the asbestos identified within the building, which has been known about for years and regularly monitored. SADC confirmed that there is no risk to public health, yet have still taken the decision to close the Alban Arena at the most lucrative possible time for the theatre and at a time that will cause most upset to the community.
Hello, this is Marion reading. This is a letter from Peter Denny from St Albans entitled "Think Again Over Arena Demolition." I know that I am not the only one among your readers to be surprised and dismayed at the council's precipitate decision to propose demolishing the arena, apparently to develop a cultural and performing arts identity. There was I thinking that we already had one in the arena itself, albeit one now in need of considerable tender, loving care and attention. Instead, on the sweeping claim that the present building is really not fit for purpose, they propose to demolish it and reconfigure the whole site, including the CCOS North area, with a central landscape zone, commercial space, underground car park, new council chamber and community hub, affordable housing and a new theatre, the latter squeezed into the northeast corner between the council offices and Brickett Road. While the overall brief for CCOS North is laudable, the proposed demolition of the arena and its replacement with a new building specifically for theatre use is highly questionable on many grounds. The most obvious at this time is, of course, the very considerable carbon impact of its demolition. Ironic for a council with extensive claims to have green credentials. No less concerning is the destruction of an important historic multi-purpose community asset. In the 53 years of its existence, the City Hall / Arena building has featured and continues to feature an amazing diverse range of events, from the Gorillaz, Motorhead, many other pop groups and tribute acts, numerous visiting centre and musical shows, the London Symphony Orchestra, George Melly, Morecambe and Wise and countless other celebrities, to performances by the St Albans Operatic Society, St Albans Schools Music, St Albans Gang Show, the annual pantomime, regular film shows, the University of Hertfordshire, graduation receptions, St Albans Beer and Cider Festival, the St Albans Model Railway Exhibition, and even professional wrestling. Clearly not only a cultural and performing arts centre, but also one at the very heart of the community. As to its fitness for purpose, as recently as 2018, in its 50th anniversary booklet, the management team stated, "Today the Alban Arena is a thriving local venue that continues to punch above its weight in the variety and scale of the events and productions it hosts. The Alban Arena plays an essential part in this historic history's entertainment and cultural scene." The underlying reason for this and for the undoubted commercial success of the venue was acknowledged to be satisfaction at the flexible nature of the seating and up-to-date production facilities, which enabled the team to cater for a wide range of users. Notwithstanding later additions that have diminished its impact, the building's location is most important in the role it plays in the city centre. Clearly visible from the hustle and bustle of St Peter's Street, within a mixture of old and new buildings and surrounding mature trees, the arena has an immediate and important presence without dominating its surroundings. Hardly something a theatre stuck behind the council offices would have. It is also an interesting building by an important 20th century architect, Sir Frederick Gibberd. As such, it deserves the same expert professional care and consideration as was given to architect George Smith's 19th century town hall when it was renovated to become the City Museum and Art Gallery. None of which is to say that the arena is currently in a good state. Even a brief look at the outside will tell you that it is showing its age, is suffering the consequences of inappropriate additions over time and needs sensitive adaptation and extension, particularly to its backstage facilities, to cater for the demands of modern entertainment, which in no way justifies it being categorised as not fit for purpose or requiring demolition. The council needs seriously to rethink its strategy on this. May I ask your readers, particularly those from the many local organisations who have enjoyed the use of the building over the many years of its existence, to join me in writing to urge them so to do.
Hello, this is Wendy. My first story is Medical Milestone. Harpenden Vax Centre marks 50,000 jabs. As the COVID booster programme continues across the country, the team in Harpenden is celebrating reaching the milestone of 50,000 vaccinations. The Harpenden Health PCN, the primary care network, which includes Davenport House Surgery, the Village Surgery and the Elms Medical Practice, began its COVID-19 vaccination programme at Harpenden Public Halls on January the 13th. Its phenomenal number of vaccinations is possible thanks to overwhelming support from the Harpenden Trust, the volunteer vaccinators and pharmacists from across the community, Harpenden Town Council, other local organisations and businesses and, of course, the patients. Dr. Bethan Rees, Clinical Director of the PCN and a member of Elms Medical Practice, said, "It has been a true community collaboration in response to the pandemic and something that we are immensely proud of." Dr. Tanya Goodwin from the Village Surgery said, "With the current COVID situation and despite the increased pressures on primary care during the winter months, we have decided to continue the vaccination program into 2022. We are grateful to all those GP practice staff and volunteers who make it possible each week and look forward to inviting our patients for their booster doses as soon as possible." Harpenden PCN Vaccination Centre Manager Hayley Gertz added, working alongside the GPs, practice managers, practice staff and community volunteers is such an honour and privilege. At the very heart of the centre is a strong desire to bring hope to our community through the vaccinations, of course, but also through the smiling eyes of our welcoming volunteers, the laughter of friends spotted in the waiting area, and the exceptional care given by each GP, nurse, pharmacist or vaccinator. It's truly a wonderful place to work. The Harpenden PCN Vaccination Centre has also risen to the Prime Minister's challenge to administer a booster vaccine to all adults before the end of 2021. In January, they are hoping for their regular clinics to resume, wherein Harpenden registered patients will receive a text invitation from their GP surgery to allow them to book an appointment for the booster dose. The Public Halls is a local vaccination centre run by local GPs, which is not available on the NHS National Booking System.
Hello, my name is Terry, and my first item is headlined 6-8% cuts to council services planned for 2022 in order to avoid £2 million loss. Sweeping cuts to council services will take place across the board next year in a bid to balance the budget. The budget gap for 2022-23, the difference between income and expenditure, is estimated at a £2 million loss unless drastic action is taken. The four committees overseeing the council services have now been told to find savings in the range of 6-8% of their current budgets by the beginning of next year. This will affect planning, waste and recycling, leisure, parks, the museums, social housing and construction projects. The committees have also been instructed to highlight any new projects, such as the creation of a new local plan and building developments, and show how these will be financed. Council leader Chris White said, "We have battled very hard to maintain services and deliver our priority projects, such as tackling climate change, during the pandemic. We will continue to do that, but it is evident that in common with other local authorities, we face significant financial challenges in the year ahead. These are principally due to the loss of income from leisure facilities and off-street parking, for which the council has not been fully compensated by central government funding. We have a statutory duty to balance the budget, which means we now have no other option, with our income having fallen, to look for savings across the full range of council services. This is not something we want to do, but it has been forced upon us by current economic conditions." St Albans District Council received a one-off government grant of £4 million to help it overcome the cost of the pandemic and overspent by £136,000 in 2020-21. In setting the budget for this financial year, 2021-22, it was agreed to use £900,000 of reserves to reduce losses. There is a projected overspend of £400,000, with around £1 million left in the main reserve fund. The Tories said they refused to support this budgetary approach, as the officers they were asking to support it were set to be made redundant soon. And especially as the Lib Dems refused their offer to work collaboratively and cooperatively on the budget. Conservative group leader Councillor Mary Maynard said, "The across-the-board approach of cuts means your strategic projects and the services that residents value most will be cut, alongside projects and services that matter less. You are pitting service group against service group, and it will be those who are most politically astute who will defend themselves from being cut, not necessarily the services and projects that should be protected. This approach will further destabilise an already destabilised and, from all accounts, unhappy workforce. In an organisation of this nature, which is essentially composed of people plus some outsourced contracts, cuts of 6 to 8% can usually only be achieved in the short term by much larger cuts in staff numbers. You are decimating the workforce. Swinging headcount cuts is not a highly motivating or welcome message to staff. We have had no information on what has been happening in terms of resignations, leavers, and empty positions for some time. We have no idea how our staff have been managed through this very difficult time. She added afterwards, "The Lib Dems are now hearing the sound of chickens coming home to roost. They came in handing out flowers, but are now handing out P45s. The big gap in the budget is their inability to recognise that our commercial projects were designed not only to deliver regeneration, but also to be revenue-generating opportunities to support the budget. For example, there is a budget gap of £1 million next year because they turned the city centre opportunity site south into a vanity project and changed the design at huge cost, thus reducing the commercial value of this project and delaying it. It should have been finished by now, with flats being sold and rented out."
Hello, this is Steve again, just interjecting briefly. The next four stories comprise the Hearts Ads review of 2021. Clearly, there was a severe shortage of news this week.
This next item is entitled "Grim Start to the Year as New National Lockdown Imposed." The start of 2021 was quite unlike any other in living memory, as rising COVID cases across the country led the Prime Minister to make a major U-turn and throw the country into full lockdown again. With weeks of disruption ahead, the Hearts Ad urged residents to support our independent retailers, pubs, restaurants and market traders by buying from them instead of online. Meanwhile, schools and leisure facilities were closed, and the Director of Public Health Hertfordshire, Jim McManus, warned against complacency as the number of COVID hospitalisations reached its highest level since the start of the pandemic. "We backed the efforts of those tasked with delivering the vaccine to the people of St Albans and took a look inside the centre at Batchwood Hall. An alliance of wildlife groups joined forces to save a rare colony of birds threatened by a housing development. Hartsmere Borough Council included plans for 6,000 new homes at Tittenhanger Gravel Pits in its local plan, risking the future of breeding tree sparrows. We remembered much-loved local footballer Lee Bozier after he passed away following a long fight against cancer, aged just 52, and the Alban Arena pleaded for patience over cancelled shows as staff struggled to cope with a backlog of refunds and exchanges. Oakland's college principal, Zoe Hancock, said farewell to the institution after 10 years at the helm, and we looked back over her time in the role, while the Bishop of St Albans called on the Football Association to lead the way in tackling sports gambling. Moving into February, and St Albans was identified as one of the best cities in the country to run in, while we looked at how the district was going to recover in the wake of the pandemic. Plans were unveiled to develop the market depot in Drover's Way for social housing, a low-key announcement which would have greater repercussions later in the year as the charter market was thrust into the spotlight and the council issued a call for sites as part of the process for a new local plan. A protected natural habitat home to rare dragonflies and newts was polluted at Smallford Pits after vandals dug out ponds, razed surrounding scrub to the ground, and poured fuel into the water. Although the police investigated this and subsequent incidents, they failed to gather enough evidence to prosecute. Top Cop Chief Inspector Linda Coates stepped aside to make way for Mike Todd, and Batchwood Hall was recognised by then Health Secretary Matt Hancock for its fantastic efforts in rolling out the COVID vaccination programme. And businesses started looking ahead to the easing of the latest lockdown. A massively flawed public consultation began into whether to replace stalls with gazebos at the Charter Market, with the Lib Dem administration claiming they needed to take urgent action to reverse £600,000 in losses over the past 5 years, while reactions to another ongoing issue, that of road closures in the city centre, appeared to suggest the majority of people were in favour of permanent pedestrianisation. 5 years after the closure of tourist attraction Butterfly World, the site was again marred in controversy after it became used for a vehicle recovery and storage facility, and thousands of acres of greenbelt land were revealed to be at risk of development in Decorum Borough Council's local plan. March opened with villagers living near Redbourne waking up to discover hundreds of trees had been felled on greenbelt land in Luton Lane, adjacent to the golf club and A5183, and we exclusively announced plans for a major renovation of the ageing Alban Arena, which were eventually revealed in more detail in November. Tributes were paid to independent councillor Tony Swendell. The green light was given for work to begin on a new children's playground at Clarence Park, and the district council was forced to introduce a tough budget to cope with a £1.7 million revenue shortfall caused by the pandemic. After what seemed like the longest Christmas holiday in history, children finally returned to school on March the 8th. We turned the spotlight on violence against women following the tragic murder of Sarah Everard, and St Albans-based CAMRA, Campaign for Real Ale, celebrated its silver anniversary. The month ended with a reflection on the 12 months since the start of the first lockdown, the challenges and achievements over this period, and how businesses, residents and councils reacted to the crisis. The fight against COVID was by no means over, as we are now discovering...
Market controversy, Lib Dem triumph and bye-bye Bob. Verulamium Park was targeted by vandals just prior to the start of April, with piles of rubbish dumped just days after Yobs trashed the £250,000 new play area Verulam School appointed its first female head teacher in the form of Julie Richardson, and we continued our retrospective look at COVID 1 year on by focusing on the work of the Harpenden Trust and the activities of the St Albans Rainbow Trail. The relaxing of restrictions on April the 12th saw pubs and shops reopening after months of lockdown, and questions were asked about whether St Albans' iconic Charter Market should be redesigned as a non-profit-making civic function. Time was unexpectedly called on the team at the White Lion pub in Sopwell Lane just hours before they were due to reopen, when Punch Taverns served them notice and the district paid tribute to the Duke of Edinburgh following his death at the age of 99. An independent investigation discovered financial irregularities at Colney Heath Parish Council stretching over 11 years and to the tune of £250,000. Councillors identified over £250,000 had been paid in ultra vires payments during the late John Dean's tenure as parish clerk. The national body representing market traders made a damning indictment of plans to introduce gazebos at the Charter Market, and many stallholders said enough is enough over changes to their contracts. Moving into May, and plans were revealed for at least 14 festivals on Greenbelt land near St Albans, we marked Mental Health Awareness Week, and Panto legend Bob Golding announced plans to quit the Alban Arena show after decades of gags and custard pies. Councillor Mandy McNeill falsely claimed that the decision to replace market stalls with gazebos was a fait accompli, with the consultation process over and decision made, something which was denied by the district council. The Harts Ad subsequently surveyed 45 traders at a Wednesday market and found 31 were in favour of a return to the old stalls. The Lib Dems bucked national trends to deal a bloody nose to local Conservatives and seize overall control of the district council, including major gains in Harpenden, and further COVID restrictions were eased on May the 17th, with customers allowed inside pubs, restaurants and other venues. A new 222k playground was opened at Clarence Park. The leader of Britain first condemned a painting portraying a black Jesus at St Albans Cathedral, and the controversy over the city centre road closures stepped up a gear as traders claimed they were having a detrimental effect on their businesses. We celebrated the life of stuntman Roy Scammell. Party leaders clashed over plans to restructure the district council, and a campaign was launched for safety improvements to the St Albans Road following the tragic death of a motorist. June saw St Albans Amnesty mark its 60th anniversary. Tailor to royalty Geoffrey Golding retired after more than 58 years, and the 5th St Albans Sustainability Festival was a resounding success. The hospitality industry faced a new crisis as recruiting staff proved more difficult following the double blow of COVID and Brexit. Residents and family members were left shocked by the sudden closure of Grace Muriel Care Home after 60 years, and plans were unveiled for more than 650 homes on the site of Aldwickbury Golf Club. Freedom Day. The proposed lifting of pandemic restrictions due to take place on June the 21st was delayed by 4 weeks. Wheat Hampstead held its first scarecrow trail, and councillors were told there was no money to buy or erect gazebos to replace stalls at St Albans Charter Market, delaying a long-awaited trial. Harts Ad reporter Laura Bill discovered the delights of naturism. Police were urged to increase patrols in Verulamium Park following a teenage gang attack, and residents of Drake's Drive in St Albans demanded an end to years of flooding during heavy rain.
Charter Market, Comedy, Pub Pride and Paddington. After months of restrictions finally over and the evident success of the vaccination programme, summer seemed filled with a sense of optimism we hadn't known for a long time. But that certainly didn't mean things were quiet in the pages of the Harts Ad, as we geared up to publishing one of our biggest investigations ever. As we moved into July, we revealed plans to sell off huge chunks of green space on the Verulam estate for potential development, celebrated the return of the Alban pilgrimage, and told how a show of thanks proposed by local Tories for the district's frontline workers for their valiant efforts during the pandemic was rejected by the Lib Dems. Pubs across the district hosted the England versus Italy World Cup final, but the easing of lockdown restrictions was accompanied by the so-called Pingdemic, as people were forced to self-isolate because the NHS Track and Trace app said that they had been in close contact with someone with COVID. We asked whether enough was being done to protect our young people from getting mixed up in violent crime, as a group of teenage boys who carried out violent attacks on rival drug dealers were found guilty of conspiracy to commit robbery and GBH. In a bid to show all sides of this shocking story, we spoke at length to the boys' family members and asked recreational drugs users to consider whether they were feeding county lines offences. Parents and staff were shocked to hear plans by Oaklands College to shut the award-winning Acorns Day Nursery on its Smallford campus with just 6 weeks' notice. Sadly, despite a hard-fought campaign to save the nursery from closure, college bosses would not be swayed, and it permanently closed its doors after the summer holidays. More than 30 pubs and other businesses joined in the city's first Pub Pride event, and developers were given the green light to build more than 150 homes north of St Albans. The first Comedy Garden event held in Verulam Park was a huge success, featuring top comedians including Dara O'Brien, Milton Jones, Tom Allen and Sarah Pascoe. And another new playground opened, this time in Harpenden's Rothamsted Park. Harpenden man Mike Joyner embarked on a six-wheel challenge in his mobility scooter to raise funds for the town's trust, and just a few months later found himself with his own monthly column in the Hearts ad. Students celebrated record-breaking exam results for GCSEs and A-levels in August, and in an exclusive interview with St Albans top cop, Chief Inspector Mike Todd, he reassured readers that the district was a safe place to live and work following a spate of violent crimes and drugs-related offences. Voles were returned to the River Ver for the first time in 34 years, but marketplace shop Masters in Light announced it would be closing after 15 years due to the impact of the controversial city centre road closures. And a campaign was launched to save Coney Heath Scout Hut from demolition by the local parish council. Moving into September, and the culmination of months of interviews and research resulted in a special edition of the Hearts ad, which featured a six-page investigation into the real reasons behind the changes at St Albans Charter Market. It was an unprecedented report, and one which won much acclaim from readers for its insightful and detailed journalism. Even now, the fate of the market still remains uncertain. Gazebos or stalls? The debate will be rumbling on into 2022. Following this bombshell report, we put the focus back onto our restaurants, pubs, hotels and cafes in the lead-up to the Nationwide Hospitality Day on September the 18th and paid tribute to Alderman Agnes Hill. Motorists endured the start of months of delays caused by roadworks on the Redbourne Road, with the prospect of similar chaos on Batchwood Drive next year, and Hartsmere Borough Council announced plans to build 6,000 new homes near London Coney in its draft local plan, with the Bowman's Cross development still very much in the spotlight now. Pub in the Park returned to St Albans Verulam Park, the nationwide shortage of HGV drivers hit the district, and climate change activists Insulate Britain began their spate of demonstrations on motorways around the area. We revealed how the city centre road closures could be a matter of life and death, as they were delaying emergency vehicles, and it was time to say farewell to the Paddington Bear seen in a window along Brampton Road for 35 years. There were two dramatic revelations at the month's end, with Councillor Robert Donald confirming the council would have to hire staff and begin erecting pitches at the Charter Market again, even if the decision was made to switch from stalls to gazebos, and his colleague, Councillor Helen Campbell, explaining how the city centre road closures were having a detrimental impact on her ward. As motorists struggled to fill their tanks during the fuel shortage, MP Daisy Cooper blasted the government for its failings over HGV drivers. Anti-vaxxers were revealed to have hidden razor blades in posters and intimidated health workers, and police refused to prosecute over the destruction of Smallford Pitt's wildlife site.
Climate action, Saints' joy, and a new COVID variant. As we moved into the end of the year, the political wranglings on the district council continued, with four Conservatives quitting the audit committee, claiming investigations ordered by councillors were being blocked. Meanwhile, St Albans Civic Society celebrated 60 years, and we took a sneak peek inside Harpenden's new Eric Morecambe Centre shortly before interviewing the cast of this year's Albanarino Panto, the first without the legendary Bob Golding. For Black History Month, running throughout October, the Hearts ad focused on the personal stories of black people throughout the district, offering them the opportunity to discuss their motivations and inspirations, including the director of charity Belong, Esther Hwangin-Yoko, addiction psychologist Jojo Godfrey, Active Lifestyles founder Andreen MacDonald, and BID ranger Herbert Agyemangdua. Also this month, linking into Sober October, we explored the rising trend for non-alcoholic drinks in the city's pubs and restaurants, and the health benefits of periods of abstinence. Following the shocking death of Southend West MP David Amos, our own Daisy Cooper pledged to remain a visible and accessible part of the local community, while reflecting on her own personal safety in the wake of the tragedy. Although Harpenden Town Council decided to reopen roads closed since the end of the first COVID lockdown, St Albans Council leader Chris White washed his hands of the issue in the city, claiming it was a county council decision whether to maintain the measures. In November, St Albans top cop, Chief Inspector Mike Todd, noted the success of Operation Luge, a massive police initiative in response to a spate of knife point offences in the district over a 10-month period. A violent gang of teenage drug dealers was jailed for a total of 42 years for conspiracy to commit robbery and conspiracy to commit GBH. St Albans City FC triumphed against League Two side Forest Green Rovers in the first round of the FA Cup, a match screened live on Match of the Day and watched by more than 4,000 fans in a packed Clarence Park. Unfortunately, their run of good luck would not continue against Boreham Wood just a few weeks later. Climate change campaigners took to the streets of the city centre to coincide with the COP26 Day of Climate Action. We revealed COVID cases for the district were in the top 10 nationwide, and the Festival of Diwali was celebrated in style by a major art collaboration between schools, a local artist, and St Albans Museum and Gallery. A dad was left traumatised after armed police raided his house by mistake. The road closure saga took another turn when it was revealed that keys to the gates had been illegally copied. And two school friends launched a 12-hour Minecraft challenge in aid of diabetes research. We revealed plans for a community of 1,000 new homes just outside Redbourne. Independent Haberdashers Fashion and Fabrics celebrated its 50th anniversary. And a couple from Strictly Come Dancing inspired local deaf children. Moving into December, and we promoted the new initiative Safer St Albans Pubs, which aims to tackle drink spiking in our licensed venues. And we revealed the news that St Albans Charter Market could be outsourced as a decision on gazebos versus stalls was pushed into the new year. The District Council announced plans to demolish the Alban Arena and replace it with a new entertainment venue as part of sweeping plans for that area of the city centre. And every single parent with children at Mandeville Primary School gave it their full recommendation in an Ofsted survey. A further expansion of Luton Airport's annual passenger numbers was agreed, despite fierce opposition from campaigners. And the Farrier's Arms, where the first branch of Camra was founded, was revealed to be on the market. The spread of the new Omicron COVID variant threw plans for Christmas into disarray, with office parties scrapped and people queuing for booster jabs. This had a major impact not only on the hospitality industry, but also the beauty sector, as bookings were cancelled in what should have been one of the busiest times of the year. And so we reached the end of the year, once again in the grip of the virus, as infection rates rise and the NHS struggles to cope. It's a depressing way to wrap up 2021. But if this year in review proves anything, it's that the resilience, creativity, generosity, and spirit of our community endures. Here's to 2022, whatever it has in store for us.
This next item is headed City's Disabled Shopping Charity Begs for Help. A charity is searching for funding and volunteers to ensure it can continue to help disabled people go shopping in St Albans. Shop Mobility, first started in 1999, provides manual wheelchairs and battery-powered mobility scooters for disabled shoppers visiting the city centre, but also to anyone in the community who might need them. The charity's office and storage facilities at Drovers Way Car Park are provided by St Albans District Council, but additional local authority funding of up to £10,000 a year was cut in 2019. Shop Mobility is run day-to-day by a small group of trustees, volunteers and one part-time paid manager, with most of the charity's costs covered by a small rental fee for wheelchairs, plus donations and raffles. However, finding funding is a constant challenge, as is recruiting new volunteers and trustees to help the existing dwindling number of stalwarts who run operations. A Shop Mobility spokesman said, "We are constantly looking for people and local businesses to support us. Anyone with a permanent or temporary disability is warmly welcomed to use our service, and we want to be able to go on providing that service." And a regular user of the Shop Mobility service added, "With my mobility challenges, it's great to know that there's a wheelchair and scooter service. That means I can still leave my house and get out and about, whether that's to do essential shopping or just meet up with family and friends." Shop Mobility's office can be found on the ground floor of Drovers Way Car Park, Drovers Way, St Albans. Its opening hours are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, and 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Wednesday and Saturday. Electric scooter and wheelchair hire is free on a daily basis during those office opening hours. Longer-term wheelchair hire is available for £1 per day. For more information, you can call on 01727 819 339, email St Albans Shop Mobility at hotmail.co.uk, or visit the website at www.stalbansshopmobility.com. The charity welcomes volunteers of all abilities.
Harband and couple who met when childhood neighbours celebrate 60th anniversary. The Diamond couple from Harpenden have celebrated their milestone 60th wedding anniversary. Bob and Barbara Kiff marked the actual occasion on Thursday, December the 16th, but have been celebrating for some time beforehand. Daughter Bev Langdon said, "This year we celebrated early and had a big family outing to Whipsnade Zoo. We wanted to treat Mum and Dad to a giraffe experience, but unfortunately they'd sold out of tickets. Not wanting them to miss out on something different, my sister Tracy and I decided to dress up as giraffes instead. It was a bit embarrassing, but it was certainly a day to remember. Not quite the experience they were originally going to get. It was in 1961 that the Hearts ad covered the wedding of a Harpenden girl who had literally married the boy next door. The original article revealed that Barbara had made her wedding dress and that of her chief bridesmaid with the help of her sister. Robert and Barbara first met when he moved to Medway as a boy and she was just 4 and a half. It wasn't until Robert did his national service years later and his mother said how he was desperate for news from home that Barbara began writing to him. They struck up a friendship that would blossom into a lifelong partnership, and shortly after they married at St John's Church in Harpenden, the couple took on the tenancy of Barbara's parents' home at Medway and eventually purchased it themselves. Bev added, "My sister is a celebrant and she carried out a surprise hand fasting ceremony on their anniversary that was very poignant. The cake was based on their original wedding cake and was courtesy of Beaker from the Coffee Boutique in Milton Keynes. They also received a message from the Queen which made their day. The Hearts ad previously covered the occasion of the Kiff's golden wedding anniversary, at which time the couple said the secret of their happiness was to go with the flow and never lose sight of the fact that there are two sides to every story." There's a lovely picture of them on their wedding day in 1961.
Saturday Morning Fever as dancers raise funds for Macmillan Charity. 200 movers took to the dance floor and raised more than £1,500 for Macmillan Cancer Support at Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre as they body jammed, fit stepped, shabammed, zumbered and funky freshed their way through a 5-hour dance-a-thon. The St Albans event was organised by Chris Dennis, Group Exercise Coordinator for Everyone Active, in memory of his dad, who died of cancer earlier this year. Chris, who used to teach dance classes himself at the centre, brought together a bunch of dance instructors, past and present, to lead the sessions and keep the energy levels up, especially important for those who managed to complete the full dance-a-thon. Macmillan Cancer Support helps around 2 million people each year to cope with the effects of cancer, providing in-depth personal support to cancer sufferers and their families. Chris said, "With all that is going on with COVID, it's important we still remember that cancer still devastates so many families and is responsible for thousands of deaths every day. I wanted to raise some money to thank Macmillan for the support they gave my family." Although there were plenty of laughs to be had throughout the 5 hours, there were also emotional moments. Regular Shabam attendee said a sad farewell to dance teacher favourite Rafaela Stadler, who has taught dance classes for 5 years at the centre and is returning to Austria to live. Raf has been such a wonderful part of the Westminster Lodge family and has introduced many local people to the joys of dance exercise while improving their fitness levels, said Chris. Her class regulars will really miss her, but we are very proud of all our instructors here at the centre and we seem to attract the very best teachers. Dance exercise is an important part of the programme of exercise classes we offer and they are really popular here because they keep you fit while being wonderfully fun to do.
£1 million restoration project saves 12th century church from closure. The major reconstruction of a 12th century Grade 1 listed church has succeeded in saving the building from closure. The ambitious project to raise £1 million to save St Leonard's in Flamstead was launched in 2017 and won the support of the National Lottery Heritage Fund, trusts and local organisations and many individual donors. Over the past year, contractors skilled in heritage crafts have recreated and repaired the badly degraded medieval windows and roof, restored traditional lime mortar to the walls, and upgraded the rainwater dispersal system to eliminate damp. Making the building structurally sound and weatherproof has saved a priceless series of medieval wall paintings, fascinating medieval graffiti, and monuments and epitaphs to ordinary villagers, landowners, and people connected with the ruling classes in Tudor and Stuart times. The church is now open again for visitors and for worship, subject to COVID restrictions. Andrew Lambourne, who led the fundraising and restoration project, said, "I'm absolutely delighted with the quality of the work and the fact that everyone will now be able to see how this amazing medieval structure was put together without unsightly temporary fixes getting in the way. The support from the community throughout the project has been fantastic, and having the church revealed again from beneath the year-long scaffold shroud made it all worthwhile. We are incredibly grateful for the support of the National Lottery Heritage Fund and National Lottery players, who make possible investment in essential projects of this kind. It's been an honour and a privilege to lead the Flamsteed Heritage Project and to see the building restored to the position where its heritage can now be shared with far more people." Joe Burke, the recently installed vicar of the benefice of Flamsteed and Markyate, said, "It's a near miracle that St Leonard's has been saved for future generations. We have been extraordinarily fortunate in the generosity of our funding, the timing of the project, and in the calibre of the professionals who have worked so hard. I am so grateful to them all. We can now look forward to a new era with a soundly built church and fascinating heritage activities led by our community engagement officer, Paul Vitti." And there's a rather beautiful colour photograph of the newly restored St Leonard's Church in Flamsteed in all its glory.
And that's the end of the news. And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in last week's and this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. The deaths announced last week were Ricky Forster, aged 58 years. Barbara Leach. Assunta Pontiuk. And Emilio Viscoliosi. And, unusually, there were no deaths announced this week. Now, a little more of Words by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up this week, which, as usual, is read by John.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. And we start with the first day of the new year, Saturday, January 1st, 2022. And the New Year's Day concert from Vienna. The Vienna Philharmonic's annual celebratory concert of waltzes, polkas and marches by Johann Strauss Jr., his family and contemporaries will ensure an uplifting start to the year. It's on Radio 3 at 10:15 a.m. 2 p.m. on Radio 4 comes Pick of the Year, in which Clive Myrie and Mariana Spring look back at the 2021 BBC Radio highlights. Drama at 3 on Radio 4 with the concluding episode of The Princess Bride, William Golding's 1973 novel. There are only two people in the world who can save the day, Inigo and Fezzik. One is lost, the other drunk. More drama at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, with Miss Marple, A Pocket Full of Rye, Agatha Christie's 1953 mystery, starring June Whitfield. In This Cultural Life at 7:15 on Radio 4, John Wilson speaks to actor Nicole Kidman about some of the most significant turning points in her career and the directors who've had the biggest influence on her. And finally, for the first day of the new year, tune into Radio 4 at 9 p.m. for political comedy The Strange Vanishing of Julian Quark. Toby Jones stars as a newly elected Prime Minister who finds himself in a political pickle. Every time he lies, a part of his body disappears. Sunday, January 2nd, Lauren Laverne's Castaway on Desert Island Discs at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is the engineer Dame Joe De Silva. At 2:45 on Radio 4 in the final episode of A Home of Our Own. This week we hear the story of Rachel and Angus, who live in a caravan in West Wales due to the shortage of affordable homes in their area. Jazz Record Requests is at 4 p.m. on Radio 3, featuring Charlie Parker, Louis Armstrong and Tina May. Followed at 5 on Radio 3 by The Listening Service, from the birth of the opera with Monteverdi to the lavish cinematic releases of the 20th century, the overture has occupied an important place in musical history. A look at how it developed and why it was largely disappeared from concerts and cinemas today. And at 6:45, also on Radio 3, comes Sunday feature, Tchaikovsky's Island of Inspiration. Lucy Ash investigates the impact of the composer's visit to the island of Vlam in Lake Ladoga near St. Petersburg. Tchaikovsky was deeply entranced by the monastery's unique a cappella style of singing, and the trip inspired his first symphony's second movement, Gloomy Land, Misty Land. On to programmes then that are broadcast each day of the week at the same time on the same radio station. So Monday to Friday, every day, same time, same radio station. At 9 a.m. on Radio 4 each day comes Rethink Population, a new series in which Amal Rajan and his guests look at the facts about population change and challenge some of the long-held assumptions. This is followed each day at 9:45 by Viewfinders, Ways of Seeing at 50. It's 50 years since John Berger's groundbreaking TV series on how we look at art. To mark the anniversary, five writers talk about an image that is important to them and reflect on how ways of seeing influence the view of art. Drama, Monday to Thursday this week at 10 a.m. on Radio 4 Extra, with the dramatisation of E.M. Forster's 1908 novel Room with a View. It stars Sheila Hancock and John Moffat and is repeated on those days as well at 3 o'clock. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 each day at 12 noon features Belize-born British composer Erilyn Wallen, born in 1958. She's the first black woman to have a piece performed at the Proms, and Donald MacLeod gets to know her as she corresponds from her Scottish lighthouse. Radio 4 each day just after midday, the very funny Subterranean Homesick Blues. Bill Nighy and Anna Calder-Marsh will star as John and Maggie, the 60-somethings defying the stick-in-the-mud residents of their Warwickshire village, even if this does mean a lifelong ban from the local fate. Finally, at 1:45 each day on Radio 4 all week, Monday to Friday, comes Past Forward, A Century of Sound. Greg Jenner explores 100 years of recordings from the BBC archive. In his first programme, we hear a clip from 1939 about the dance craze of the day, the Lambeth Walk. On to programmes then for the rest of this week, starting with Bank Holiday Monday, January 3rd. And the drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 entitled United Kingdom captures contemporary life across the UK with a series of short plays focusing on laughter. Beyond Belief at 4:30 on Radio 4 this week looks at the importance of the 5 Ks of Sikh identity. In 1699, Guru Gobind Singh formed the Sikh Khalsa and announced that its first 5 members should wear the 5 Ks to demonstrate their devotion to their faith. Today the 5 Ks are still important symbols of Sikh identity. In The Untold, at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Grace Dent presents the story of James and Courtney, who swap their rented house for a sprinter van, halve their working week and set off on the open road, just as COVID swept the UK. At 9:30 on Radio 4 comes Pride and Prejudice, How We Read Now, a series of 3 programmes broadcast Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, in reaction to the recent uproar about the content of fiction and the introduction of sensitivity readers at publishing houses. Abigail Williams looks beyond this to explore the power of the novel. On to the working week then, starting with Tuesday, January 4th, 11 a.m, Radio 4, a new series, The Coming Storm, in which Gabriel Gatehouse investigates the QAnon conspiracy and how it led to the storming of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. a year ago. The lunchtime concert at 1 o'clock on Radio 3 presents over the next 3 days a series of Dvorak piano trios, all recorded at last September's Prague International Music Festival. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Isaac Newton, Nemesis. In the late 17th century, England faces a financial crisis, so Warden of the Royal Mint, Isaac Newton, comes up with a solution to recoin the entire currency. Front row at 7:15 returns, Samira Ahmed announces the five category winners of this year's Costa Book Awards and interviews the winner of the first novel award. 8 p.m. Radio 4, Pakistan's long game. Owen Bennett-Jones examines the long game Pakistan played in the US defeat in Afghanistan, securing its objectives while simultaneously receiving billions of dollars of US aid. And from 10:30 p.m. through to 7:30 a.m. on Radio 4 Long Wave and on Radio 5 Live Sports Extra, the opening day of the fourth Ashes Test against Australia from the Sydney Cricket Ground. Surely England can do better than in the first three tests against the Aussies. They've lost, of course, 3-0 so far. Wednesday, January 5th, 11 a.m. on Radio 4 comes Now the 12th Night Show, in which Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis offer a unique take on Shakespeare's comedy using archived extracts from various stage, TV and radio productions of the play. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Fake Heiress, about the scandal that exploded around wealthy New York socialite Anna Delvey in 2017, when it was revealed she was in fact Russian-raised Anna Sorokin, a magazine intern who'd conned thousands of dollars out of businesses and friends. Radio 3 in Concert at 7:30 p.m. features Daniel Barenboim and his West Eastern Divan Orchestra in a concert from last August at the Salzburg Festival. Listen to Beethoven, Brahms and Franks. Or you may prefer to listen to The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe at 9 o'clock on Radio 2, and it features a live performance by Leicester singer-songwriter Grace Petrie. Thursday, January 6th, Crossing Continents at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, entitled Turkey's Crazy Canal Project. A report on the controversies raging about the ambitious plan proposed by Turkey's President Erdogan to build a giant new canal that will slice through Istanbul and create, in effect, a second shipping lane to rival the Bosphorus. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Vital Signs. Writer Ben Musgrave explores how one day in 2018, his greatest fear came true. His heart stopped. 3 o'clock on Radio 4, Open Country. Recorded in December in the teeth of Storm Barra, Ian Marchant experiences Dartmoor at its wettest and windiest as he travels back thousands of years with archaeologists to a time when the moor was anything but wild and empty. And Radio 3, in Concert, 7:30 p.m. tonight, features charismatic French mezzo-soprano Marianne Crébas in Berlioz's song cycle La Nuit d'Été. You can also hear symphonies by Schubert. And finally, Friday, January 7th, a new comedy by Hugh Dennis and Steve Punt again. 11:30 a.m, The Train at Platform 4. A four-part farce that succeeds in sending up recent real-life glitches on our rail network. Second episode of Steelheads is the drama at 2:15 on Radio 4. A terminally ill professional tennis player is cryogenically frozen to await a cure, but when she awakes, she finds a world in chaos. 7:15 on Radio 4 comes Screenshot. David Bowie would have been 75 on January 8th. To mark the occasion, the British Film Institute have launched a month-long season celebrating his work in cinema. Mark Kermode speaks to Bowie collaborator Tilda Swinton about her memories of working with him and about her favourite performances from his acting career. And as we round off the first week of the new year and this week's radio recommendations, why not tune in to Classic FM's Smooth Classics with Margarita Taylor from 10 p.m. till the early hours, music designed to ease away the stresses and strains of the day. May I be the first person to wish you a very happy new year. Here's to much joy in 2022. And may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Now we have a selection of audio-described TV programmes coming up this week. And this is from the Otley District Talking newspaper. So, as always, many thanks to them.
Happy New Year to you all. Here's John's selection of audio-described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday the 1st and ending on Friday the 7th of January 2022. So, starting on New Year's Day, Saturday the 1st, unsurprisingly, there are lots of feature films, starting with The Sound of Music, starring Julie Andrews, and that's on BBC One at 2:20 p.m. At 5:10 p.m. on Channel 4 is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Slightly later, on ITV3, at 5:15, is Carry On Camping. Then there are two films at 8:30, ITV has Downton Abbey, When the King and Queen Come to Visit. Or on ITV2, there's the James Bond film, Skyfall, starring Daniel Craig as Bond. Other programmes today are Doctor Who at 7pm on BBC One, The Great New Year Bake Off at 7:40 on Channel 4, and a new series called The Tourist on BBC One at 9, a mystery thriller set in the Australian outback. A man is pursued by a truck which is trying to run him off the road. Later he wakes up in hospital and has no idea who he is. Sunday, 2nd of January, can start with Nigel Slater's Simple Cooking, and it will give you some useful tips, and that's on BBC Two at 11:40am. Another feature film, on BBC Two this time, at 2:05, is The Ipcrest File with Michael Caine as Harry Palmer in this counter-espionage thriller. This is followed at 3:50, still on BBC Two, with The Eagle Has Landed, a wartime adventure with the German paratroopers who plan to kidnap the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is on Channel 4 at 5:30pm. Have you been watching Around the World in 80 Days? Well, parts 3 and 4 are on BBC One, starting at 6:20 and 7:10 respectively, tonight. A new series, The Great Pottery Throwdown, starts on Channel 4 at 7:45pm, and the hopefuls start by throwing a children's crockery set and some ceramic milk bottles. This is followed at 8 on BBC One with the first of a new series of Call the Midwife. Demolition works in Poplar unearth a long-buried secret. There's a historical drama on BBC Two at 9pm, Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary returns to Scotland to reclaim her throne and causes a complex and vicious power struggle. Finally on Sunday, a new series on ITV at 9pm, Anne. It's the true story of Anne Williams' son, Kevin, who died in the Hillsborough disaster, but following the story from Anne's point of view. This four-part series is on every night at this time until Wednesday. Then on Thursday is the documentary The Real Anne, Unfinished Business, following the three decades Anne has fought to uncover the truth of what happened on that day in Sheffield. Now a look at programmes on at the same time each day of the week. BBC One, 11:15, is Homes Under the Hammer. Then still on One, but at 12:15, Bargain Hunt. There's a new series of Father Brown on BBC One each day at 1:25 today and then at 1:45 for the rest of the week. Rick Stein's Cornwall is a new series starting on BBC Two at 6:30pm. There's a repeat of Winter Walks on BBC Four at 7:30, starting with Selina Scott walking around Wharfdale. The soaps continue in their regular slots. EastEnders on BBC One at 8pm, Emmerdale on ITV at 7pm, Coronation Street on ITV at 7:30 and 8:30pm, although these two programmes do jump about a bit later in the week. Hollyoaks on Channel 4 at 6:30pm, Home and Away on Channel 5 at 2pm today and 1:15pm for the rest of the week, and also still on Channel 5, Neighbours at 6pm. Looking now at programmes for Monday the 3rd of January, David Attenborough has a new programme on BBC One at 6:30pm, Attenborough's Wonder of Song. The contention that only songbirds sing is dispelled as David plays songs from animals who have developed this strategy to stay alive. If you follow the soaps, you might be interested in Coronation Street Soapy Slip-Ups, a look at the outtakes from the cobbles of Weatherfield. You can see this on ITV at 8pm. There's a new series on BBC One at 9pm, Four Lives, a fact-based drama based on the crimes of Stephen Port, who murdered four young gay men in London in 2014 and 15. Also at 9, but on BBC Two, Inside Dubai, Playground of the Rich. Well, the title says it all, really. On Channel 4 at 9pm, 24 Hours in Police Custody, a behind-the-scenes look at the investigation into the death of an 11-week-old baby, which shocks even the most experienced officers. The concluding part is tomorrow at the same time. Don't forget part 2 of Anne tonight on ITV at 9pm. Now on to Tuesday the 4th of January. Yesterday we had Coronation Street outtakes. Well, today it's the turn of Emmerdale at 7:30pm on ITV, where you can see all their bloopers. Holby City is on BBC One at 7:50. Jack's plan to impress the hospital inspectors is in danger of backfiring. Digging for Britain starts a new series on BBC Two at 8pm. Professor Alice Roberts visits archaeological sites in the east of England, including one in Rutland, where a huge Roman mosaic was found under a farmer's field. This is followed on BBC Two at 9 p.m. by The Hunt for Bible John. In 1968 and 69, three women were murdered in Glasgow. One witness described a man who picked on women and quoted extensively from the Bible, hence his name. This investigation hears from those involved in the case, which has never been solved. BBC Four looks at killer storms and cruel winters at 9 p.m. Dr. Lucy Green reveals how some of the UK's ancient and most dramatic weather disasters occurred. And Part Three is on ITV at 9. On Wednesday the 5th of January, and starting with a new series of The Repair Shop on BBC One at 8 p.m. On the bench for repair this week are a pair of biker boots, an electric organ, a fragile diary and a writing slate, and Steve and Will complete a grandfather clock project which was started many years ago. The second part of Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 8. Tonight Alice is in the south of the UK looking at discoveries made at the HS2 construction site. Also at 8, but on ITV, is Paul O'Grady's For the Love of Dogs. Paul is at Battersea Dogs Home. BBC Four has the final part of Thailand, Earth's Tropical Paradise. Today, The Mysterious North. Britain's Most Expensive Homes is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. and looks at a London road known as Billionaire's Row, where a broker tries to find a buyer for a £17 million house. On BBC Four at 9 p.m, The Windermere Children, a fact-based drama following a group of children, survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, who arrive in the lakes in 1945. This is followed, still on BBC Four, at 10:30 p.m, with The Windermere Children in Their Own Words, the story featured at 9, but as told by the children themselves. It's the final part of Anne on ITV at 9 p.m. On to Thursday the 6th. Dragon's Den starts a new series at 8 p.m. on BBC One. Cheesemongers Explain Their App and a robotic invention are two of the products looking for investment in tonight's programme. Channel 4 has The Doghouse at 8 p.m, following the animal charity Wood Green as they try to match abandoned dogs with new owners. Did you miss The Sound of Music on New Year's Day? Well, there's another chance to see it on BBC 4 tonight at 8 p.m. Part 3 of Digging for Britain is on BBC 2 at 9 p.m. In North Yorkshire, Alice visits Richmond Castle, which was a Norman stronghold and was later a prison for conscientious objectors. Channel 4 at 9 p.m. has a new drama, Screw. Set in a men's prison at Long Marston, Lee Henry bends the rules to help prisoners in her care. As I said earlier, tonight at 9 on ITV is The Real Anne, Unfinished Business, following the three decades that Anne has fought to uncover the truth of what happened on that day in Sheffield. Finally, to Friday the 7th of January, there's a new series, Would I Lie to You, on BBC One at 8 p.m. It's not already described, but it's a panel show with only shots of panellists, so you should be able to understand what's going on. I hope so, anyway. At 8 p.m. on BBC Two, Monty Don's Adriatic Gardens. Monty explores the influence of the Venetians by visiting green spaces hidden behind high walls just off the Grand Canal in Venice. There's a new series of George Clark's Amazing Spaces on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. George visits Val, who has built a stargazing cabin, with a twist. Another new series, this time it's Death in Paradise, on BBC One at 9 p.m. When a seemingly straightforward kidnapping ends in murder, Neville and the team must work out why it went so badly wrong.
Here's an article from the BBC website, and it's entitled The Mystery of the Home Where the Queen Was Born. Where exactly was the site of the house where the Queen was born? Have visitors been looking in the wrong place? And are claims that the house was damaged in the Blitz correct? The Queen was born on the 21st of April, 1926, at 17 Bruton Street in Mayfair, London. Not a palace or big estate or even a hospital, but a townhouse on a busy London street. Her parents had moved into the house, belonging to her Scottish grandparents, the Earl and Countess of Strathmore, only a few weeks before her birth. It's a reminder of how the royal family was not as flush in those days. Money was an issue, says royal historian Robert Lacey. Bear in mind, the Queen was not born to be Queen. At this point, as daughter of the King's younger son, she was not expected to take the throne. The Queen's first home no longer stands, and there are persistent claims online that it was a casualty of air raids during World War II. The house was damaged in the Blitz and was later demolished, says Wikipedia, as one example of many. But armfuls of documents in the British Library and other archives show that the 18th century house was gone before the war had even started. It was property developers, much more relentless than air raids, that finished off the Queen's first home. In 1937, a man in a top hat and frock coat had formally begun the demolition of 17 Bruton Street and many of its neighbouring buildings stretching around the corner into Berkeley Square. There had been plans to build a hotel for the Canadian Pacific Railway, but the site was eventually cleared for a big office and retail complex. These were unsentimental times about architectural heritage. Without a glimmer of regret, demolition gangs flattened what was described by one report at the time as 20 of the most historic houses in London. A poignant drawing by the war artist Sir Muirhead Bone recorded workmen pulling down the facades of the elegant old buildings. If there were any further doubt, a surveyor's note from May 1939 in the London Metropolitan Archive closed the file on the original 17 Bruton Street with a confirmation that the old house had been demolished and its site forms part of that upon which Berkeley Square House has been built. Astrea, the firm currently running the Berkeley Square House site, says a new building on the site was occupied by the Air Ministry in the run-up to World War II. But there's another frequently repeated claim about the Queen's birthplace, that the site is now a Chinese restaurant. This again is not the full story. The Huckerson restaurant has the same 17 Bruton Street address, but so does a stretch of boarded-up office in the same block. There's also a glass-fronted corporate entrance and reception area next door. All of this extended business block is built over what in the 1920s would have been a row of individual private houses. It might not be such a romantic story, but it's the rather anonymous corporate entrance that seems closest to the site of the original 17 Bruton Street, a side entrance into some offices in Berkeley Square House. In the London Metropolitan Archive in Clerkenwell, there are bundles of old files and architects' drawings with Art Deco lettering showing the layout of the original house. They show the lost house would have been around this entrance area, with the frontage stretching down towards what is now a car showroom selling Bugattis and Bentleys. This is confirmed by Westminster City Council, whose planners say this can be plotted against the boundary lines of the original properties on the other side of the street. One end of the restaurant would have overlapped with the original house, and Huckerson General Manager Sharon Whiteman says the royal connection is a brilliantly interesting talking point, which goes down well with our guests. Much of the Queen's old home is now replaced by the corporate glass of the entrance next door. There are two plaques on an adjacent wall marking the birthplace, including one from Westminster Council. These have been moved as buildings have been altered and are at one end of the original site. There's no official blue plaque because a spokeswoman for English Heritage says they have to be on original buildings, and also they don't put up plaques for living people. Toby Cuthbertson from Westminster's planning department says this would have been a high-class, first-rate London property, 5 bays wide, but the very wealthy would have been another step up, in the types of houses that had names rather than numbers. When the Queen was born here in 1926, her royal grandparents came to see her on that first day. Queen Mary recorded in her diary that her granddaughter was a little darling with a lovely complexion and pretty fair hair. It's also where the Home Secretary, William Joynson Hicks, hurried, as it was then still protocol that the Home Secretary was present for such a royal birth. He was considered such an authoritarian, he was nicknamed Mussolini Minor. This was the house where the Queen's mother, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, had set out in April 1923 for her wedding to her shy suitor, the then Duke of York. They returned here for the birth of their first child almost exactly 3 years later. The house was also in walking distance of the Harley Street practice of speech therapist Lionel Logue, who from 1926 helped the future king overcome his stammer. This would have been a Mayfair of upper-class parties and fashionable gatherings, but it was also of politically volatile and divided time. The general strike was called only a few weeks after the Queen's birth, and her grandfather, George V, had cautioned, "Try living on their wages before you judge them." The Queen and her parents moved later that year to a bigger house in Piccadilly. There were subsequent plans to convert the house in Bruton Street into offices, with architects' drawings showing how the rooms, including where the Queen was born, would have been panelled and partitioned and redesigned for office workers. The room on the first floor, in which the little princess was born, is one of the least ornate of all the rooms, but also one of the sunniest, read a newspaper account at the time. But the house was later demolished, and remains a curiously low-key site for such a historic place. There can't have been many private houses in London which were the family home for a future king and two queens, yet it's barely on the tourist trail. "I think it reflects the general modesty of the Queen," says historian Robert Lacey. "She doesn't blow her own trumpet." The site is still part of a royal estate, but these days it belongs to the estate of the royal family of Abu Dhabi, part of a portfolio of property in this part of London said to be worth £5 billion. The original 17 Bruton Street was managed in the early 1930s by Howard Frank, co-founder of the Knight Frank Estate Agency. Simon Burgoyne, now working for Knight Frank on property in modern Mayfair, says this fashionable area was, at the time, where landed families, with estates in the country, had their London townhouses. But after the war, no one could afford to keep these big old rambling buildings, so a lot of them were turned into offices, he says. "This has now come full circle," says Mr. Burgoyne, "with offices being turned back into luxury residential property. If the house had survived, it would have been worth well over £25 million, he says, and possibly as much as £100 million. But the house was flattened in 1937, and in another unexpected turn, by then the young Elizabeth and her parents had moved into Buckingham Palace. The abdication crisis of 1936 had seen her father take the throne as George VI, following his brother Edward VIII's planned marriage to an American divorcee, Wallis Simpson. Mrs. Simpson had been followed by special branch officers during this political maelstrom, and they had noted claims that she had had an affair with a car salesman called Guy Marcus Trundle. In a final twist, the address where they found this charming adventurer was 18 Bruton Street, now appropriately part of the Bentley dealership. We now have a repeat of the fifth episode of the 10 Today exercise program.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Mike, and here he is.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to 10 Today, broadcast number 5. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either stood up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you to do this exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the session. So if you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember, you agree to take part at your own risk. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair that you can sit upright in, which could be a dining chair, preferably without arms, which could get in the way in some exercises, and sit with your feet flat on the floor. Okay, if you're stood up, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders, and stand up nice and tall. Take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor. Keep your back straight, relax your shoulders, and take a couple of deep breaths. In and out. In and out. So, the first exercise is called supporting the sky. Raise both arms together straight up to the ceiling with your palms up, and then turn your palms to face down and push down. And again, so hands up and hands down. And repeat, remembering to push up with those palms supporting the sky and down. And now, keep going. This is a really good exercise just to get those wrists moving, and it stretches the muscles in your arms and shoulders, which can often get a little tight. It's also just a nice, gentle warm-up. So we should have just a couple more now. So hands up with your palms up, and then palms down and hands down. And one more time, hands up and hands down. The next exercise is called dancing the rainbow. So you want to move your feet a little bit wider than hip width apart into a wide stance. You raise your right arm straight up with your palm up and push down. Now do the same with the left arm. Up and down. And keep going, remembering to turn the palm down on the way down. Keep going, alternating your arms. This is a really good exercise for strengthening those shoulders and arms. So keep going, remembering to change those arms and facing the palm up to the ceiling when you press up, and then palm facing down when you press down. So the next one is called kick the ball. If you're standing, I recommend you're near something that you can hold on to for balance. So if you swing your right leg forward, keeping it as straight as possible, and then swing it back to standing. So swinging your right leg, and keep repeating that action. If you're chair-based, straighten out your right leg right in front of you, feeling the nice stretch down your leg. Then return your foot to the floor, and repeat. So whether you're sitting or standing, you're just swinging your right leg forward and back, imagining there's a ball in front of you that you want to kick. Do this a couple more times. This is great for mobilising your hips, stretching your leg, and improving your balance. Now we're going to do exactly the same for the left leg. So swing your leg forward and back, forward and back, keeping that leg nice and straight. You might be starting to feel your heart rate go up a little now, but that's great. It just means you're building up your strength. And now a couple more times. We should all be feeling nice and warm now. Next up, it's the twister. Place your hands on your hips, relaxing those shoulders, and twist your upper body to the right, and then twist back to the centre, and then to the other side. So just keep twisting your upper body from left to right, feeling that nice stretch in your side. And just keep going for a few more times.
Good work. Definitely, you should be feeling warm now. Next up is moving legs. Again, if you're standing, you might want to be near something you can hold on to for balance. So raise your right leg out and straight. Then move it to the side so you feel that nice stretch in the top of your leg. Then move it back to the centre and back down. Repeat this with the left leg. So lift your leg up straight out in front, then move to the side, then back straight and back down. So that's up, to the side, back straight and back down. And again, do that a couple more times. This is really good for your hips, tummy and thighs. Slow and controlled is more challenging and rewarding, so keep going. And remember to keep the leg straight. Lift your leg up straight out in front. Then move to the side. Then back straight. And back down. So up, to the side, back straight, and back down. And just a couple more times. Now we have circle the sky. Raise both arms together, straight up, and circle them in a small circle twice, using your shoulders to move too. And then push your arms down. And again, raise your arms together, straight up, circle them round twice, and push down. So raise your arms up, circle one, two, and push down. Again, this is a really good one for getting your shoulders moving and building up strength. Keep going, really moving those shoulders and arms. We should all be getting warm now. If you want to make it a little harder, move your shoulders in even bigger circles. So just a couple more here, lifting the arms up, circling twice, and pushing down. And just one more. Good. Next is going low. These exercises are slightly different if you're sitting or standing. So if you're standing, place your feet hip width apart, bend at your knees, and try to keep your back straight. And then straighten up your legs again. Keep your feet facing forward and try not to let your knees move in front of your toes. So you're just moving up and down by bending your legs. A little bit like a mini squat. If you're sitting, just straighten out your right leg right in front of you, feeling that nice stretch down your leg, then return your foot to the floor. And repeat on the other side. Whichever variation you're doing, you're working your legs. If you're standing, you're also working your bottom. Okay, so keep going, always remembering to keep your back straight. And for those of you who are standing, bending knees down and then up and sitting, raising alternate legs. If you're standing, can you make it more challenging by going down slowly and holding at the bottom briefly? Just a few more. Next, butterfly wings. So this is a nice exercise where you're rolling your shoulders back. Bend your arms so both hands are at chest height, and then use your arms to move your shoulders back in nice large circles, using both arms at the same time. If this is a bit challenging, you can do one arm at a time. So keep moving, circling both arms from the back. This is great for the shoulders and upper back. So keep moving. They can be quite energetic, these, make the circle as wide as you can and keep going. Just a couple more now. Now we have charging the fists. Whether you're standing or sitting, place your feet hip distance apart in a strong stance. Clench your fists, holding them at chest height, and then punch out with your right hand and pull back. And repeat the punch with your left. Keep going, punching with alternate hands. It's a great stress buster, this one. Really think about how your muscles are responding here, making the punches slow and controlled. Just a couple more now. Good job. Now, we really should all be feeling warm. If you're feeling a little out of breath, well, that's a good thing. It means you've been working. If you're not a little out of breath, I think you could probably work a little bit harder next time. Anyway, we're nearly finished for today. We'll just finish off with a nice stretch and cool down. So we're going to start with a hamstring stretch. So step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean forward slightly. And whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of the leg. Hold it for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then return to a standing position and swap your legs. So this time step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat out on the floor. Then bend your right leg and just lean forward slightly. Again, feeling that nice long stretch. Hold for another 10 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you're hugging a tree, directly in front of you. And your arms, they form a nice circle in front of you. Then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. Again, another 10 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, sit up or stand up and return to that nice, relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant. So, that was all the exercises for today. I hope you enjoyed them. Just to finish off, shake it out. So, just shake those arms and hands, and then your legs and feet. Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have great health benefits. It's fun and you'll simply feel better. So do keep going. Thanks for listening.
We now have our piece of music, Words by Goffby, in its entirety. Thank you. And now, here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 1st of January, 1879, the British novelist E.M. Forster was born in London. He was registered at birth as Henry Morgan Forster, but he was accidentally baptised as Edward Morgan Forster. I guess the name Edward must just have stuck. He is most famous for three of his novels, A Room with a View, Howard's End, and A Passage to India, all three of which were made into successful feature films. On the 2nd of January 1938, the British photographer David Bailey was born in Leytonstone, then in Essex. Along with Terence Donovan and Brian Duffy, his photos captured the spirit of swinging London in the 1960s. The three were the first celebrity photographers and were described by the more established and slightly more conservative Norman Parkinson as the Black Trinity. In addition to fashion, Bailey has photographed musicians such as the Rolling Stones, Marianne Faithfull and Alice Cooper, as well as directing TV commercials and documentaries. On the 3rd of January 1892, J.R.R. Tolkien, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, was born in Bloemfontein in South Africa to a British couple. The British writer and university lecturer is most famous for his novels The Hobbit and its sequel The Lord of the Rings. He was a gifted linguist and created several languages himself. He was also a friend of the writer C.S. Lewis. After his death in 1973, his son collected some of his earlier writings, which were published as The Silmarillion in 1977. On the 4th of January 1965, Craig Revel Horwood was born in Ballarat, Australia. He is a ballroom dancer, choreographer, theatre director and former drag queen, but he is best known as one of the judges on the BBC's flagship show Strictly Come Dancing. He started his career in Australia, but moved to Britain in his early 20s. He has choreographed and directed several theatre productions and regularly appears in pantomime. As a footnote, Revel is actually his middle name. His surname is just Horwood. On the 5th of January 1965, Vinnie Jones, the British former professional footballer, actor, producer and presenter, was born in Watford. As a player, he was known as a hard man. He was sent off 12 times in his career, and he holds the record for the fastest ever booking in a football match in Britain, after 3 seconds in an FA Cup tie in 1992. After retiring from football in 1998, he took acting roles in several films, most famously Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. On the 6th of January 1955, Rowan Atkinson was born in Consett, County Durham. The comedian, writer and comic actor came to prominence on the BBC comedy show Not the 9 o'clock News, with Mel Smith, Griff Rhys-Jones and Pamela Stevenson. This led to 4 series and several specials of Blackadder. His other comedy creation, Mr. Bean, has given him international fame, and it was inspired by Jacques Tati's character, Monsieur Hulot. On the 7th of January 1985, Lewis Hamilton, the British Formula One racing driver, was born in Stevenage. He is widely regarded as one of the best drivers of his generation. He has won the Formula One World Championship 7 times, equaling the record of Michael Schumacher. He won the world champion once with McLaren, and in 9 seasons with Mercedes, he has won it 6 times, come second twice, and fourth once. And finally, some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 1st of January 1901, the separate British colonies of New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, Tasmania, and Western Australia were united to form the Commonwealth of Australia. Melbourne was the temporary seat of government, but there was a great campaign between Melbourne and Sydney to become the permanent capital. In the end, a compromise was reached when the government of New South Wales agreed to donate part of its land to create the Australian Capital Territory in 1911, and the adoption of the new city of Canberra as the capital of Australia. The New South Wales government were happy because Canberra is much closer to Sydney than it is to Melbourne. The 2nd of January 1921 saw the world premiere of the highly successful science fiction play R.U.R. by Czech writer Karel Čapek. It is this play that gave the world the word robot. ROR stands for Rossum's Universal Robots, and the play depicts robots as artificial humans made from synthetic organic matter, and they can be mistaken for humans. Initially, the robots are willing to work for the people, but later revolt, which ends very badly for the humans. On the 3rd of January 1959, the territory of Alaska was admitted as the 49th state of the USA. Alaska had been bought by the USA from Imperial Russia in 1867, after much encouragement from the British government, who feared that the Russians might invade Canada. After Alaska became a state, the US flag had to be changed with the addition of an extra star. The previous 6 rows of 8 stars became 7 rows of 7. However, the next year, Hawaii became the 50th state, and the flag had to be changed again to its current pattern of alternating rows of 6 and 5 stars. On the 4th of January 1958, the Soviet Union's Sputnik 1, the world's first artificial satellite, fell back to Earth and burnt up in the atmosphere. Sputnik 1 was launched in October the previous year and caused great consternation in the USA, who were having repeated failures in launching satellites. Sputnik 2 followed Sputnik 1 in November 1957, whilst the US Navy's attempt with Vanguard 1 exploded on the launch pad in December of that year. The US finally succeeded in putting a satellite into orbit with Explorer 1 in February 1958. After this shaky start, the US eventually overtook the Soviet Union in the space race, reaching its peak with the manned Apollo missions to the moon. On the 5th of January 1933, construction of the Golden Gate Bridge began. The bridge spans the Golden Gate, the entrance to San Francisco Bay, and links San Francisco itself to the town of Sausalito. When it was completed in 1937, it was the longest and tallest suspension bridge in the world, with a main span of 4,200 feet and a height of 746 feet. Between them, the Golden Gate Bridge and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge have contributed greatly to the growth and development of San Francisco, which had suffered badly from poor communication links. On the 6th of January 2021, supporters of the then-President of the USA, Donald Trump, attacked the US Capitol building in Washington, D.C., in an attempt to overturn the result of the presidential election. Trump had consistently repeated false claims of election irregularities and encouraged his supporters to attend a rally on the 6th of January near the White House. For several hours, demonstrators occupied the Capitol. There were 5 deaths and several hundred injuries. Trump's incitement of the rioters led to his being impeached for a second time. He is the only president to have been impeached twice. On the 7th of January 1610, the Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei discovered 3 of the 4 major moons of Jupiter. He found the 4th a week later. At first he thought they were stars that happened to be close to Jupiter, but observations on the following nights showed them to be orbiting around the planet. This caused a revolution in astronomy, because the belief at the time was that all heavenly bodies revolve around the Earth. In 1633, he came into conflict with the Catholic Church over his views on the nature of comets, and he was found guilty of heresy. He was sentenced to house arrest, under which he was held for the remaining 9 years of his life. And with that, we come to the end of this programme. Many thanks to Gabby, Marion, Wendy and Terry, our readers today. To Angela, who wrote the radio highlights, and to John, who read them. To Mark, who makes all the copies of the programme, and to Michelle, who ensures you get yours. So that's all from News Extra for December 2021. Goodbye.